Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our show today, we will look at the hundreds of unincorporated communities in the Central Valley that go without the basics of services. We will talk to the reporter who did the research and find out why these areas are being neglected. Plus, Beth Caffrey with the Fresno SPCA talks to us about the future of the organization. And World Book Night, how you can share a favorite book with people in your community. But first, the Central California Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals has cut its ties with both the city and county of Fresno after providing services for over 50 years. In recent weeks, the agency has faced heavy criticism from animal rescue groups who say they can do a better job of handling and caring for lost and abandoned pets. Beth Caffrey, Community Relations Representative with the SPCA, is here today. First of all, Beth, thanks so much for coming in and joining us.
Good morning.
My first question is, what went into the decision to cut the ties with the city and county?
Well, this was a decision that weighed very heavily on our board of directors. This changes a lot of dynamics for the community, for the organization itself, and for the animals that we care for so much. So it was very difficult for them to make this decision. Our board of directors took a lot of things into consideration. But basically, they wanted us to get back to the roots of who we are as a humane society, which means focusing on exactly what our name means and our mission statement, which is to be there for the animals, but really to address things from the front end of the problem. So we want to be able to focus more on spaying and neutering, because that's what's really going to change things here in the Central Valley.
When we say cut ties with the city and county, what does that mean? Will you all still be here? How does that work?
Basically, what that means is that we have ended our contract with the city and county for animal control services. That doesn't take effect until October 1st. So we will still be the same organization all the way up until that point. What we won't do is that we won't take in stray animals. We won't have officers that go out to pick up stray animals.
Now, is that now, or does that begin in October?
That begins in October 1st. So we've given the city and the county 6 months to be able to transition into taking over animal control. And, of course, we'll be there for any help that they may need with that transition period. And then what we will still do is that we will still have our location that we're at. A lot of people think that we're moving, but we're not. We will still do adoptions. We'll still take owner surrenders. We will still have officers that will go out and do cruelty investigations. So similar to how we just got the amount of horses that we have, we're still at about 37 horses on our property. Those were cruelty investigations that those animals came into us from. So our officers will still do those.
What do you think of all the criticism, and how did it impact the agency? I mean, did that have anything to do with the SPCA saying, now is the time for us to try to get back to what we were trying to do? How did that impact you all, the agency, and your decision?
Well, the recent criticism is pretty much just misunderstandings. There's a lot of things that go into animal control, what you have to deal with when you're handling that. And then there's also things that are industry standards. And one of the things that got very publicized was the fact that we had asked the rescue groups to sign an agreement that was basically the same verbal agreement that we had before, but now it was in writing. And this is an industry standard. Most organizations have them so that everybody knows what their responsibilities are, and you put it into writing so that you can both agree on that. So that was pretty much a separate issue. Everything got tied together. Our board of directors has considered this every time we do budget negotiations, because it costs more every year to be able to handle the amount of animals, provide the level of care, but our contracts have been slowly dwindling. And so they've kind of been all muddled together, but they're separate issues, definitely.
are part of this, or was it the factor or the realization that the SPCA would never be able to please everybody?
And that's pretty much what we see with all animal controls. When we're talking with other organizations and metropolitan areas such as San Diego, Sacramento, all of those areas have kind of seen the same dynamic. It is hard to please everybody because you're dealing with just too much. And you've got to be able to have a level of staffing, a level of availability to cover everything. And that just becomes more and more difficult.
Okay, we are going to open our lines and for people to call if you have any questions, but more to the line of what would you like to see animal control be? And do you think that we or the city or county, if that's enough money to really do what it is, an animal or animal control agency should be able to do? You can give us a call at 800-224-8989, 559-275-8989, or email us at talk@kvpr.org. Back to you, Beth. What are some of the challenges that you think the public really just doesn't see that you all faced as an agency?
Well, basically, it's kind of dividing up all of the services. Because what we do is that most of our staff wear multiple hats. They cover lots of different areas. And that's one of the things that we don't really get to shine a light on. Because we're dealing with a flood of animals, because we're trying to be there for the community that has all these animals and keeps creating all these animals, that's where it gets really difficult to be able to differentiate between the fact that we may have a humane officer that is also dealing with an animal control issue that also has to do a cruelty investigation, that's also trying to get a case through the DA's office, and that's just one individual within our organization. So there's so much involvement to everything. I mean, we have licensed enforcement officers that do a good job, but they weren't received really well by the community because people looked at them as trying to tell them that they had to have a license, and they didn't like that in a tough economy. But basically, we saw our license investigators as wonderful educators because so many more animals were actually spayed and neutered because they were out in the field going door to door and visiting with everyone. So again, we understand that there's huge misconceptions on both sides of the fence. We do invite everyone to contact us with their questions, what their concerns are. And we address those, whether it's on a one-by-one basis or if it is sitting down in a meeting and going over things with people so that they do have a better understanding.
And a lot has been said about the budget. You know, you all get about $2 million from the city, a little less than $1 million from the county, which is a wide area.
Right.
You know, so I'm looking at that thinking, wow, how do you make that fit?
Right.
You know, is that enough? And what do you really need to do your job? Because even now, when you sit here and you talk about your different workers that you have, and that they're all doing several different things. I don't think people even think about the fact that you have somebody who's working to try to get something through the courts. I mean, that's
right,
huge, and it's very time consuming. Anybody who's dealt with the courts know that.
Right. And that's the thing is that, first of all, I do want to put in a huge thank you to our staff. Our staff has stood through all of these difficult times. They're all compassionate people, and it has been very difficult on them because they're at the receiving end of all this criticism when every single day they have to be there to care for the animals, pick up animals, to help the citizens. And on the budget end of it, we did ask the city a couple years back to actually do a survey of other agencies that handled similar dynamics that we do. And it's quite expensive. I don't think that anybody came close to what we were, and we don't like doing it this way, but breaking it down per animal, what the cost is. We are less than a third of what every other animal control agency is to be able to care for the amount of animals. So we're very under budgeted is what that study told us.
So you say you're very under budgeted, but it to really do what you need to do, how did you manage then?
Well, that's where we have wonderful staff that really stepped up, that even though they haven't gotten raises in many years, they were willing to take on more duties, try to fit those duties within an 8-hour day, which is very, very difficult. They were willing to learn more tasks so that we could cover more ground with that same person. We juggled shifting our shifts so that we could cover everybody because we've always been a 24-hour-a-day, 365-days-a-year operation. And that's where, again, our staff did an impeccable job of juggling what they had to, but it's just very difficult.
How many animals are we talking about a year that you all either see come through the shelter or that you deal with?
Well, our projection for this year is going to be 55,000.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so that's where it's increasing. We do see that spaying and neutering is working. Spay, neuter, and education definitely works. In the 70s, we were up at 70, almost 80,000 animals that were coming through our doors. And if you think about what we had per capita human-wise, that should have grown. It would have exploded animal-wise. So it does work. Because we've been doing this for 50 years, we've been the leader, certainly in the Central Valley and in the state, of trying to do programs and show people how to get their animals spayed, neutered, and be responsible pet owners. But again, because you do need funding to be able to promote a lot of these things, it gets more and more difficult the more that those funds are taken away.
What is going to be your next step? I mean, like you said, you've informed the city and county. You will be there for the next 6 months. What kind of transitioning will you be doing?
Well, we're going to be doing some restructuring. So we'll look at the programs that we currently have, everything that we're doing, and we'll start to set up for the things that we will continue to do and be able to look at how we're going to handle those along with adding new things. We've always done mobile adoptions, for example, but we have a brand new mobile unit that's coming in that we're very excited that we had a donor help us with. So that mobile adoption unit will allow us to go out into the community to other areas, do adoptions, education, and outreach. I'm certain that we'll look at a spay-neuter program, something that will make it a little bit more convenient for people, that will make it fill in some of the gaps that we have, because we have wonderful opportunities in the community for spaying and neutering, but we need more.
But one of the things when it comes to the spaying and neutering, because of what you've done through the SPCA, you probably have a pretty good knowledge of really what it's going to take when to try to get more people to do this.
Exactly.
And what you're up against.
Yes, we do know what we're up against. And that's the part that we're excited about, is that we actually get to focus on that. We won't get to kind of juggle the same emergencies that we had to, so we can really focus on where the gaps are.
And we have David. Do you have a question?
Yeah, please. I have a wish that the SPCA or shelters would take a firmer stand on pit bulls. Recent journal in the American Veterinary Association article states that pit bulls there was a Rottweilers, but mainly pit bulls are responsible for over 50% of all dog bite related fatalities. And yet I've been to two or three different shelters and just asking casually what the feeling is about pit bulls, and I get an immediate response that they're just like any other dog, and they'd be happy to give them have them be adopted by any family with children. Now, I think that's really irresponsible, and I think it's an issue with the with the shelters, because, for example, the San Francisco shelter had 50% of their dogs were pit bulls. I just wish the SPCA would come out and say, you know, public, pit bulls are not a good dog to have. We euthanize them when we get them, and they're just too dangerous. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling, David. How do you answer something like that? I mean, I think it would...
Well, first of all, we don't believe in breed discrimination. It's all dogs can bite. That's one of the educational programs that we have for children, because it can be Any dog can bite and can bite severely and cause a lot of damage. And there are several breeds that we currently work with that are not pit bulls that have done some serious injuries to human beings. We do agree that you have to be responsible with your animals. And that's the other part that we'd like to focus more on is pet responsibility. We have a free training class that people can come to be able to train their animals. And that's what we see is that a lot of times people get animals, don't spend the time to work with them. Don't even try to keep them in or have them be responsible pets. And that's part of what causes this issue that pit bulls get into trouble with is because you don't have a responsible person dealing with them.
Right. You go out and you get the dog and you buy the dog without ever understanding what it's take,
right.
What it's going to take to be a pet owner of a dog like that.
Right. Well, and the other problem that we see is that people sell animals to make money. And especially here in the Central Valley, they want to sell an animal that's going to make quick money for them. And that's something else that we would like to see tougher regulations of. It's not allowed. And we would also like to educate the community. Don't go that route because you don't know exactly what you're getting yourself into. And if you've already gone into that situation, then come to us so that we can help you with training.
And I think also... You know, David, I understand where David is coming from. You know, I'd be afraid of a pit bull or, you know, some of the other bigger breeds of dogs. But as an agency, you just can't come out and say, oh, okay, I'm sorry, this dog is not welcome.
Well,
and
we
would be criticized for that.
Right. And we've looked at other communities that have actually banned them, and it doesn't work. It doesn't solve what the issue is. And the core issue is that human beings are the ones that have to deal with animals. And we have to do a better job of getting those human beings educated and dealing with those animals in a responsible way.
And, okay, that's a good answer to David's question. We talked about what's the next step for you. What are some of the things you want to do?
Well, we're really excited about being able to be out there in a higher educational capacity. We've never stopped doing humane education. However, it's been really difficult to juggle humane education with all of the fires that we have to put out on a daily basis. So we're excited about getting into schools, getting back out into more group community efforts that are out there so that we can educate the public to be responsible pet owners, but also to get those resources that they need. So many times we see that people don't even realize that there's spay-neuter availability here. So education and outreach is certainly going to be one of our primary focuses. And, of course, along with that is making it convenient, easy, understandable spay-neuter. Because a lot of times people have fears, and to be able to address those fears so that we can overcome an animal not getting spayed or neutered is going to be huge.
Well, you know, what you're talking about, what you want to do, really, if I can recall, that was just really the basics of so much of the criticism. Oh, there's not enough education about spaying and neutering. There's not this, not that. It seems like that is not the fact that you didn't want to do it. It seems like
right.
There were so many other things that got in the way.
Right, and that's part of it, is that we are really concerned about the animals, and we do care for them, and we do want to make sure that the next step is going to be a good one for them. However, when you're dealing with that flood, and when you're dealing with all of the things that come from that flood of animals, it's really difficult to be able to do all the proactive front-end approaches on those, and that's where we will be able to focus on the front-end approach that's actually going to make a difference here in the Central Valley.
Are you going to work with the city and the county during this transition as far as trying to help them understand what is really needed and what kind of priorities they should look at?
Oh,
and focus
certainly.
On?
Yes, definitely, because they do need all of that information. There's a wonderful document by Dr. Hurley, which is the shelter standards, that a while back we had given to the city, let them know about it. And basically, it's kind of letting you know the dynamic of what's going to be needed for a nice, healthy shelter to keep the animals in a better light, healthier, and everything else. Those shelter standards are wonderful. However, they are expensive to be able to meet. We also have given them lots of other dynamics to really look at, other animal control agencies, other cities, and dynamics that will help them in what they're looking for that's going to be a good setup for them to be able to perform animal control.
And when you're just now talking about that, it's the realization as well, you all are going to stay at your facility, then they're going to have to find another facility and with that much space.
It does take a lot of space and a lot of supplies and a lot of manpower to be able to care for the amount of animals that we have here in the Central Valley.
And when it comes to you all making the transition, you know, where will you be getting your funding?
Well, we will, of course, as we always have, turn to the community to keep helping us to donate to things that are going to be productive. So we will continue to do that. We will also certainly look at grants. One of the things that we have noticed with a lot of the grants is that when you are doing animal control, we were kind of stuck in the middle of a chasm because of the animal control side of us. We weren't actually government animal control. We're a private 501. So that kind of left us out of a lot of those grants. So that's something else that we'll be looking at. We'll be doing a lot of fundraising.
And, you know, last week we spoke to Kristen Gross with Madera County, and that's the way they're funding. She said it's not enough, but, you know, the County Board of Supervisors oversees them. They're a county agency, and so they're dealing with the budget cuts, and they have to deal with furlough days.
Right.
So that happens when...
Right. And we've had lots of other agencies that have asked us to take animal control, other areas, because it's a huge expense. And it is difficult to, your manpower payroll is the biggest expense that you have. And so that can be very difficult. And so we completely understand that. And, in Madera, they've done some really neat things because it's their private 501 that gets to be able to do fundraising and do things that's not in a government capacity.
Okay. Well, Beth, thanks for coming in and clearing up a lot of things for us and asking, answering our questions. And we do wish you the best in the future and would love to hear how it's going once you get going.
Well, we'd love to come back, and please visit our website at ccspca.com. We have lots of questions that are already up there from the community, and we'll address others if the community would like to ask them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Cahuilla Delta Medical Center and Kaiser Permanente.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. There are hundreds of them, small, unincorporated towns located in the Central Valley. The residents go without the basics of clean drinking water and a sewer system. Why have these areas been neglected? We talked to Bernice Young, a reporter with California Watch, a center for investigative reporting, and Veronica Garibay with California Rural Legal Assistance. First of all, Ms. Young, I'd like to start with you. Could you describe the areas that we're talking about, and where are they primarily located?
The areas that we're talking about are various unincorporated communities throughout California that tend to be lower income and dense, and they can be found in various places across the state, but there are many in the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, as well as a number in the East Riverside County area, the Eastern Coachella Valley. I looked at four in particular, one in Fresno County, Lanier, which Veronica works very, very deeply with, as well as Park Lawn in Modesto or near Modesto, and Thermal in the Eastern Coachella Valley, and finally, Matheny Tract near Tulare.
Could you describe these areas? Basically, what do they usually consist of?
These communities, they essentially lack some pretty basic forms of infrastructure that would that are known to promote public health and safety. So we're talking about everything from sidewalks and streetlights to sewer systems and potable drinking water. A number of the communities, like Lanier, for example, don't have potable drinking water coming from their taps, and so they have to purchase water for drinking and cooking on top of paying for water that they can't drink that comes from their sinks. In other instances, there are also problems with septic tanks that are just old, or they're not situated in places that allow them to function properly, and so residents are sometimes dealing with backflow into their homes or surfacing sewage near their homes.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is, how did these areas just pop up? That's what I'm trying to find out. I mean, do they have a structure? Is there a government structure or anything like that? Or did people just move there and kind of set up home?
I think Veronica can also address this additionally. But as I understand it, they were essentially communities, many of them that kind of developed over time. So they've been around for decades. They're not actually just cropped up. They've been around for 40, 50 years, often started out as low-income housing areas for people working in agriculture or the agricultural industry. And over time, cities have developed around them, but there's little sometimes financial or political motivation to incorporate these cities or annex them into nearby cities. And some of them are a bit far out in rural areas, and so lack the resources potentially to incorporate themselves into their own city. And so they've just kind of slipped the cracks policy-wise in the past.
Veronica?
Bernice is exactly right. I was just going to add, usually there's three different types of communities, what we call island communities, which are completely surrounded by city boundaries and are within the cities, and then fringe communities, which are either in the sphere of influence of a city or adjacent to the sphere of influence. And finally, legacy communities, which is Lanier, are geographically isolated, densely populated communities that came to be because of agricultural labor camps, or Bernice said, working in the agricultural industry.
Is part of the problem, not all, but many of these areas were populated by people who came here to work in the fields. And housing was never really, I don't know if housing was never really provided for them. They came up with their own housing. And thus, it really wasn't ever addressed.
I mean, it could have been. I mean, a lot of these communities came to be because they were labor camps in the day, or there was also policies in cities where people of color couldn't purchase homes or property within city boundaries. And most, like in Matheny Tract and Lanier, it started out with a large property owner parceling out properties and allowing people to come and move their trailers and eventually more permanent housing to come in into the communities.
How did they get the voice? Why wasn't their voice heard? I mean, you can say, yes, they're disenfranchised, yes, they're poor, but if they're living in an area and you don't have a sewer system or you don't have clean drinking water, you know, don't you kind of show up to either the board of supervisors or your city council and say, here's a problem here, what do we need to do to address it?
I think that's an issue, and it's an issue that we find working in unincorporated areas, is that they've been historically excluded from the process for so long, or often case the diverse educational backgrounds in the communities. They've been left out of the process for so long, and the bureaucratic government is so convoluted and complex that oftentimes you don't even know who to turn to or who to call, or when you call an office to make a complaint, let's say about raw sewage in your backyard, or you don't have clean drinking water, and you try and make a call and you get redirected and redirected and redirected, and you don't know who that point person is because of the complexity of the bureaucratic government today. It's very difficult for them to navigate. And, you know, residents from these communities know what the issues are. They know that they don't have drinking water. They know that they don't have, you know, adequate sewage system. They know they don't have street lights, sidewalks. They know that in their community, there is no promotion of health and safety in these areas. And that, you know, once they come together and identify the issues, and, you know, they have the resources and the technical support to be able to navigate this process, then communities like the leaders that are outlined in the story here, they're leaders. They're working on behalf of the communities day in and day out to make it known that this is not right and this is not fair, and there needs to be more awareness and more attention focused in these areas.
In your article, you mentioned you had a statement from Assembly Member Henry T. Perea, who talked about the communities being very small, in poverty, and in many cases, the residents undocumented, so that put them at a disadvantage. Was that for so long the real problem?
I don't think so. I think that the issue is knowing who to go to and how to get around government, how to get the attention of, you know, decision-making officials to be able to respond to the needs. I think that, you know, that's been the hardest piece. Like, who do you go to? Or, you know, knowing that you have the basic right to have basic services.
Well, in the situation of Lanier, the county supervisors are aware of the problem. And from what I can read, their take on it, well, if they want these services, then they've got to tax themselves and find a way to pay for them. So is that what they run into as well?
They do run into that a lot as well. And that's the issue for a lot of these small systems where they do want drinking water and local government turns around and says, well, if you want to do this, you need to tax yourselves. And what ends up happening in a community like Lanier is that it's such a small community that there are no resources, no technical assistance dedicated to this area that they don't know
how. That you could even tax.
Yeah, but how do you go and apply for technical applications, do the engineering, do all this work when you're in an unincorporated area with no resources to navigate this bureaucratic process to even get these basic services? And, you know, in this case, the Board of Supervisors is the representative body of these areas. There should be dedication of resources and technical assistance to these areas because what ends up happening, especially in Lanier, is they have a special district, what's called the Lanier Community Services District. It's made up of 5 volunteer residents from the community who give their time to try and improve their community. And what ends up happening is, you know, decision-making bodies say, well, your special that's their job. They're supposed to give you clean water. They're supposed to give you sewage. They're supposed to give you streetlights and sidewalks. Well, how will a 5 volunteer board provide and have the resources and technical capacity to navigate complex, you know, grant applications to get all those services? And then, you know, when it comes to street lighting, the community does an assessment or a fee. How will they navigate all that process without any attention, any support from their representative body, which is the County Board of Supervisors?
Well, what is the solution in a situation then like Lanier? I mean, how could they work with the county to get some of these services?
And they can. They can work with the county. And it's happened recently where Lanier has a community group called Community United in Lanier. And this community group works to advocate for improved conditions and a healthier, livable, sustainable community. And recently they went to the Board of Supervisors to get their support in applying for a Caltrans Environmental Justice Planning Grant. And this grant is what it would do is do sustainability planning for improved pedestrian safety measures and traffic measures like sidewalks, paved roads, signage, crosswalks. And, you know, they had quite a bit a struggle there because there was a local match requirement that would have ended up being $3,000. The county eventually, you know, came approved to provide that local match with in collaboration with the Fresno Council of Government. But that's exactly one way, working together with community residents. The community residents said, we're willing to support. We're willing to do our part. We'll do the outreach, the education, and we'll make sure the community's engaged. We want to work with you. We want to make our community better. And we're not here to ask for a handout. We're not here to ask, give me, give me, give me. We're here to work with you to make our community better. And, you know, that's one way that some of these communities, by engaging with the decision makers and being allowed to be at that table and have that voice, makes such a difference.
Bernice, is how much of what many of the residents in these communities are facing are people's attitudes toward them? What did you find when you were out talking to people about this?
I found that there was quite a range of response, and that's actually still the case as the story has been published, and I've been receiving some comments from various readers. It kind of mirrors the sentiments of many elected officials in that there's a really broad range. There's the perspective that these are communities that need more assistance and more attention, all the way to the belief that because some of the residents of these communities are undocumented, that it's a problem that they perhaps asked for. So the reaction is really across the board. you know, and I think it just depends on a lot of different factors.
Do you see any willingness on the part of, you know, some of the officials you talk to who could help by reaching out to these communities? Do you see any willingness on their part to kind of work with them?
I do. There are a number of statewide elected officials and local officials who are very aware of what's happening, and they're doing what I think what they've told me is their best under very difficult financial circumstances for the state. I think, as we all know, the state and kind of the national economy is not at its best, and so there is that wrinkle to the resolution of this issue, in that dollars are harder to come by than ever. But that's not to say that there isn't funding available for these kinds of upgrade projects. You know, there is state bond money and grants. There's also federal USDA and HUD grants. And Veronica mentioned another transportation grant that would potentially allow Lanier to put down sidewalks and other kinds of infrastructure. So it is out there. But as Veronica mentioned, it can be very difficult. It's quite bureaucratic. And one source that I spoke with mentioned to me that a lot of the grant making and a lot of the funding and the application process for applying for these funds was conceived with often government agencies or developers in mind. And so they haven't really broken it down for the average citizen and made it as easy as could be. And so there are actually organizations, California Rural Legal Assistance is one, but also self-help enterprises that have kind of taken it on as their work to help translate and assist with this kind of grant-making and funding process.
And, you know, one unfortunate, we had the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act 2 years ago that really provided a one-time unique opportunity of stimulus funding available for infrastructure improvements, which was would be able to support these types of communities, because it was all grant money, all in the form of grants money for local government. And we did an analysis of Fresno County and Stanislaus County of how much ARRA money actually came down the pipe for disadvantaged unincorporated areas, specifically for wastewater and drinking water projects non-existent. And you know, it was very unfortunate for, you know, this money to come down and not be ready. And a lot of it, you know, the law itself had a clause that said projects have to be shovel ready to receive any of the money. The money has to be spent within the first 60 days of allocation. And that was very unfortunate, because this essentially left these communities out of the running, out of this money, because they don't have shovel-ready projects. They don't have the engineering. They don't have the planning to submit for these grants. And, you know, had, you know, local, for instance, you know, county board of supervisors, planning departments really, you know, put some of these applications together for these areas, it would have been a really good opportunity to provide to get a lot of money that was available.
Why is there so much resistance? And part of it could be, as we mentioned, attitudes on the part of the governing bodies. Let's say in our area, if we look at Tulare and then Fresno County, I think you mentioned one track, the Matheny track. I think that's the one in Tulare County. And I'm not going to reread it, but there is a quote from one of their council members that basically says, you know, the people living there like it like that. And so how do you get past those kinds of attitudes if people feel like, this is the way the people who live there want to live? So they're not reaching out to them, and they're not saying, let's work together to try to solve this situation.
I think that what's an interesting aspect of all of this is the difference between living in a community that you love for a variety of reasons, ranging from you enjoy your neighbors to you enjoy some of the rural aspects of your home, to some of the freedoms that you have in more rural areas, versus not having certain infrastructure in place. And so what I think often plays out is there is a debate, a discussion going on in many of these communities related to whether they would want to be annexed or would want to be incorporated or want to be part of a city. And for a variety of reasons, some residents prefer their unincorporated status because there are certain liberties that exist when you're living outside of a city kind of construct. On the other hand, there's still a need and an interest in having safe and healthy communities and infrastructure. And so that's where the tension is, where I think they're not mutually exclusive. I think that some of the residents would like to remain in the communities that they're living in, perhaps in an unincorporated area, but they would like to receive the modern upgrades that they see around them throughout the state and in the nearby cities.
Then how do you accomplish that? Because it really does come down to funds. And if the people like the, and not everyone, as you mentioned, some people prefer to live in unincorporated areas because you have that all over too, not just, and really the poor areas, you do have certain communities around the state where people want to remain incorporated for whatever reason. But when you do that, then you kind of have to provide your own services, don't you?
I think that's one of the biggest policy challenges to all of this is, and it's a question I think that is still being considered and discussed amongst policymakers: who should pay for all of this, and how? And I think perhaps the question also is: should we, as a state, or as citizens of California, do we believe that there's a baseline standard for our residents? And then if so, then the question is, where can this funding come from and how should we go about implementing these infrastructure upgrades? But I think all of this is still being, in some ways, hashed out at a policy level. And there has been some policy. There's legislation that was passed last year that takes a huge step forward in terms of requiring cities and counties to begin to consider these communities in urban planning beginning in July. And there's other legislation on the table currently that's being considered that would also begin to facilitate improved infrastructure for these communities. But it is a very complex scenario because there are so many different jurisdictions and involved and different authorities involved.
Exactly.
And sometimes teasing that apart is quite a handful.
Veronica, what role can your agency play, and what are you doing at this point to try to start bringing solutions to some of these problems? Because, you know, you can't have people living with, you know, sewage backing up in their homes and not even having basic clean drinking water.
Yes, we, California Rural Legal Assistance has a program called the Community Equity Initiative. And our program focuses on disadvantaged and unincorporated areas and also very low-income neighborhoods like West Fresno here. And we work alongside community residents to develop advocacy strategies to really promote environmental justice, promote fair and equitable investment of public funds, encourage, you know, and increase civic participation and civic engagement, the decision-making table, and do a lot of education and outreach and give the fundamental, that foundation for residents to meaningfully engage in the process. And one thing that we've always said, you know, it's really meaningful and very inspirational to see a group of community residents, concerned community residents, at the decision-making table, engaging with their decision makers, with local elected officials, making decisions, speaking the same language, speaking the same, you know, holding that same vision and that same, you know, hope that everybody, regardless of whether you live in an unincorporated area or within city boundaries, everybody has a basic rights, should have access to basic services like potable drinking water, adequate sewer systems, street lights, safe traffic calming measures, other issues that come up with it. And we work with community residents, and we work with all of the communities outlined in the California Watch story: Lanier, Matheny Tract, Parkland, Rancho Garcia, the Eastern Coachella Valley. And those are just some of the few communities that we work with. We covered the entire San Joaquin Valley and the Eastern Coachella Valley. Our organization is a statewide organization. And we really work with residents to identify those solutions will identify the priorities for them. They know, communities know what the issues are, and they identify their priorities. What do they want to see in their community? Obviously, we would love to, you know, be able to give, the communities would love, and, you know, I think all of us would love to see all these changes happening in 1 year, happen in 6 months. And, you know, we know that that is not the case. And we really work with residents to, one, be at the table, have their voices heard, be recognized as residents, given that dignity and respect that we all yearn for and that we all ask for in every aspect of our lives. And also, you know, work and engage collaboratively with decision makers, with the planners, with the engineers, with the elected officials, with the decision makers, really engage with them and engage in a collaborative process that will work towards identifying a solution. And Bernice referred to Senate Bill 244 that was authored by Senator Wilk last year, that landmark legislation that for the first time will have counties and cities identify and locate where these communities are at and start identifying what the infrastructure deficits are in these areas and figure out a way to start addressing them so that we don't continue through this phase of neglect and abandonment of these areas. These are residents like all of us that, you know, all they want to see is have a good, livable, sustainable community, healthy community for themselves and for future generations. And, you know, there's a belief that, well, if we don't invest in these communities, if we withhold services like water and sewer, maybe they'll just go away. And that is not the case. In fact, Tulare County had a policy in their general plan that said withholding major services like potable drinking water and sewer will, you know, will essentially make these communities non-viable, which is really unfortunate. And, you know,
I mean, considering what needs to be done, I'm sure you have some officials who would like for them just to go away and not have to address the issue.
Right. And, you know, I think it's important to really work with the communities, work with the residents. It's really important that they be at the table. They know what they want. They know what they need. And they know how to really, you know, get local government to see what their flight is, to see what their issues are and see, hey, this is where we're coming from. You know, we want services just like everybody else. And we're not asking for super fancy stuff. We're asking for potable drinking water.
OK. Bernice Young, investigative reporter with California Watch, and Veronica Garibay with California Rural Legal Assistance. Thank you both.
Thank you
for joining us to shine more light on this issue.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. With the November election growing closer by the day, there's been no shortage of claims by politicians about their own records and those of their opponents. But how is the listener supposed to sort through all of the overheated rhetoric and find the truth? Commentator Diane Blair has some suggestions on this week's edition of our commentary series, The Moral Is.
The recent debates over the birth control mandate in Congress remind us that how we talk about an issue shapes what we understand about that issue and how we respond. For some advocates, the birth control mandate was framed as an important protection for women's health care. For others, it was framed as an attack on religious freedom. Rhetorical critic Kenneth Burke reminds us that every way of seeing is also a way of not seeing. And what we say not only reflects reality, but is also a deflection of reality. While politicians and activists may have legitimate disagreements over how to interpret a situation, it's important to consider how that framing positions us as audience members. Of even greater concern may be the situations where politicians feel entitled to their own facts. For example, during a recent debate over the federal budget, Senator John Kyle took to the Senate floor and declared that if you want an abortion, you go to Planned Parenthood. And that's well over 90% of what Planned Parenthood does. When the senator was confronted with the actual fact that only 3% of the services Planned Parenthood provides are abortion-related, his spokesperson replied that the senator's remark was not intended to be a factual statement. Even more recently, presidential candidate Rick Santorum claimed that euthanasia accounts for 10% of the deaths in the Netherlands and that half of those people are euthanized involuntarily because they are old or sick. When these claims were disputed by Dutch government officials, Santorum's campaign explained away the flagrant inaccuracy as being a matter of what's in his heart. These examples illustrate how our political discourse has moved beyond distortions and exaggerations to include unapologetic use of objectively false statements. While consumer protections exist for truth in advertising when it comes to commercial products, the same is not true for political speech because of First Amendment protections. The only standard we have to protect ourselves against false and misleading information in political rhetoric is an informed and thoughtful public. However, recent research in cognitive psychology casts doubt on the degree to which people can dislodge an idea once it has been set in their minds. A study by psychology professor Norbert Schwartz argues that the conventional wisdom of countering bad information with accurate information can actually contribute to the resilience of a myth or false statement. Denials often require the repeating of the bad information, and this repetition may actually reinforce the inaccurate information. When something is repeated, it becomes more accessible in our memory. And according to this study, one of the brain's subconscious rules of thumb is that easily recalled things are true. So when politicians speak with great certainty and are only later held accountable for such false or hyperbolic assertions, the damage may have already been done. Our only defense in such a situation is an actively engaged public, one that approaches all political discourse with a healthy dose of skepticism. We need to recognize that our natural cognitive functioning can be taken advantage of by someone trying to manipulate public opinion, and we need to actively seek to fact-check our politicians and their spokespersons. One possible resource is factcheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit website whose researchers are dedicated to evaluating the truth quality of politicians' claims and messages. For the sake of our democracy and the quality of our public deliberation, we all must become rhetorical critics, informed, engaged, and critically equipped consumers of the persuasive messages around us. For The Moral Is, this is Diane Blair.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Now, we have a great event coming up here in the Valley, and if you love books and want to help spread the joy of reading, you'll want to participate. Here to talk about World Book Night is Jean Finnessy with Petunia's Place, a place we all remember, especially if we have kids. First of all, welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming. And for what is World Book Night?
World Book Night is an annual celebration designed to spread the love of reading and books. It began last year in the United Kingdom, and this year it's occurring across the United States. In over 5,000 communities and cities in the U.S., people have signed up to pick up boxes of books that they will be handing out to primarily to adults who are not currently avid readers or who read just a little bit. And the purpose of it is to spread the love of reading.
And how will this work here locally? And I think one of the things I read is it's just not any books. You want the readers to really, the volunteers to think about getting books that they really enjoyed and want to share.
Right. There were the American Booksellers Association, along with other organizations, are sponsoring this. And 30 books were chosen, and people could sign up, and they selected three titles that they would like to give away, and they were given one. And the books range from things like Maya Angelou's I Know Why a Caged Bird Sings to The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins to Because of Winn-Dixie by Kate DeCamillo to even Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible. It's a wide range of books. And people will have already been selected because they signed up to do this. And each person will get a box of 20 copies of their particular book, and they will be giving them out to wherever they chose to do so. It might be Valley Children's Hospital. It might be to a shelter. It might be to a school classroom, a variety of places. And we're excited to find out who the people – where the people at that are coming to Petunia's Place are going to be giving their books.
So let me just get this straight again. So the people who give the books, they pick out a book, favorite book of theirs, and then they will get additional copies of that book to give away?
They will get 20 free copies of that book. The publishers have published paperback copies of this, a special edition. Authors have given up their royalties. Printers have printed them. UPS is delivering them. Ingram Book Company has organized the shipping out of them to via UPS. And the books will be delivered next week to bookstores and libraries that are participating, as Petunia's Place is. And then the book givers are being notified to come to their particular place. And they will pick up their box of books, and they will take them out on April 23rd to share them with their community.
Now, for us locally, what were some of the books the readers picked here?
You know, I don't know. I won't know until we actually have our books arrive and have the book givers that are coming to Petunia's Place. When they come to pick them up, we'll find out what books they got. I do know that a number of people asked for Because of Winn-Dixie. It's one of the two books that are designed for younger people. Most of the books are adult books.
Okay. So the volunteers, how many do you have?
We have more than 20 that will be coming to Petunia's Place. So if you think about it, that's 400 books that are going out to the community. And there are other people now who want to be involved, and the recommendation is to sign up for next year. It will probably be much bigger.
Well, yeah, this being the first year, everybody right. sees how it works, and it sounds like such a wonderful event. It's just a great way to kind of get people, you know, to kind of love a book that you once, that you loved.
Right, and I think that's what's so remarkable about this is the number of organizations that have come together nationally to support this financially. If you think about the 5,000 communities having people come to particular libraries and bookstores sharing books, it's a lot of books.
You know, I wonder if this is also part of an effort. Just, you know, there are a lot of people, no matter if you have e-books, e-readers, whatever, there are still a lot of people who just love a book.
Absolutely. There, nothing replaces that feeling and that smell of a good book.
And it's another way just to kind of keep that
it
alive.
Is, it is definitely a way to promote not only the value of reading, but the value of printed books.
And again, your volunteers are going to come. Now, World Book Night is the 26th.
World Book Night is April 23rd. People don't have to give them out that night. They can give them out in the daytime or sometime during that week. But they can't do it before April 23rd.
And when are they going to come again to pick up?
They will be coming. The people that we know, the people that have been assigned to Petunia's Place or who chose Petunia's Place as the place they wanted their books delivered. So we will have a special gathering for them next week on the 19th. And we will celebrate the fact that they are going out. We'll honor them. We'll find out where they are planning to give out their books. And then we hope to meet with them again afterwards, too, to find out how it went.
And people were really encouraged to kind of go to locations where, you know, there are people who can't get out that much.
Absolutely. And we have people who are giving them, for instance, to schools where there are children who normally don't have the finances to be able to own their own books. We have one young man who's going to be giving them to homeless people. We have someone else who's going to Valley Children's Hospital, where her great-granddaughter has been a patient for some time. So a wide variety of places. We're excited at Petunia's Place to find out where all these books are going to be going.
What a great event. And we just wish for a bigger and better event next year.
Absolutely.
As more people find out about
That's
this.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Jean Finnessy, with Petunia's Place, for coming in today
Thank
to tell
you.
Us about World Book Night. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, productions and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.